Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the media, self-promotion or serving the truth? Pope Benedict releases his message for World Communications Day. As the 100th Christian Unity Week draws to a close, we take a look at the dialogue between the Catholic Church and the Anglican Communion. And whose world is it anyway? The head of Caritas Internationalis takes a hard-hitting message to political and business leaders gathered for the World Economic Forum in Davos. Benedict's message for World Communications Day was released at a press conference here in the Vatican on Thursday. The message is entitled The Media, at the crossroads between self-promotion and service, and it was presented by the head of the Vatican's Council for Social Communications, Archbishop Claudio Celi. My colleague Emma McCarthy went along to the press conference to find out more about this new papal message.
Introducing the papal text to foreign journalists at the Vatican press office, Archbishop Celi said that media can be instruments of hope when they are used correctly.
We cannot imagine the actual world, the actual life of humanity without the positive contribution of the media. Mutual understanding, the path of peace, solidarity. The medias are really the positive instruments of such a development of the human life.
In his message divided into six parts, Pope Benedict goes on to note the precious and decisive role that media continues to have. Monsignor Paul Tai, the recently appointed Undersecretary to the Council, explains.
The wonderful good they've done that the document picks up on very clearly, with the help of bringing about things like literacy, bringing communities closer together, helping to create a better democracy in different situations. I just think if we think back to quite recently how maybe the international awareness of what was happening in Burma came because individuals were able to use, be it only cell phones, to make known to the outside world what was happening. And there's great potential there.
But the Pope also warns against a far darker reality in modern media, underlining that new technologies are only a means and not an end in themselves. Unfortunately, he writes, these new technologies risk being transformed into systems aimed at subjecting humanity to agendas dictated by the dominant interests of the day. Moreover, the Pope points out, in certain situations, the media are used not for their proper purpose of disseminating information, but to create events. Archbishop Celi says this happens when media are not committed to the search for truth, but to self-promotion.
The problem is again that man is behind such instruments of life. Man is expressing himself through the medias, but the destinatory of such a communications are again man. And this is the delicate aspects of medias. Because if you don't respect truth and you don't respect the truth of man, really you are facing new problems in life. And I think that this is the real aspects, the real mission, I would say identity and mission of the medias today, searching for the truth.
Concluding his message, Pope Benedict writes, many people now think there is a need in this sphere for info ethics. Monsignor Tai points out that this is just one way to avoid the media becoming spokesmen for economic materialism and ethical relativism, true scourges of our time.
It's clear at a very simple level. Often you hear what's called cyberbullying within schools for young children. Constantly one's reading of various situations in which the internet is serving to diffuse child porn and the exploitation of children, slavery and the abuse of people and their dignity. So we just want to watch and be attentive to ensure that the new technologies are put into the best use.
And my thanks to Emma McCarthy for that report. Pray without ceasing was St. Paul's message to the early Christians as they began to disagree over the interpretation of their faith. and pray without ceasing is also the theme for this year's Week of Prayer for Christian Unity, exactly 100 years after the first Octave for Church Unity was inaugurated in New York by an Episcopalian vicar, Father Paul Watson, who later converted and became a Catholic priest. To further this ecumenical mission, Father Paul and Mother Lurana White co-founded the Society of the Atonement, which today works in countries around the world in social ministry, justice and peace, and above all, the promotion of Christian unity. Over the past 40 years since the Second Vatican Council, the annual Week of Prayer for Christian Unity has become such a regular observance, it's worth taking a moment to look back and recall just what a bold and brave initiative these pioneers of the ecumenical movement were taking back in 1908.
It was indeed a very brave initiative, and over the last 100 years, it has become a regular and fixed feature in the life of most Christian churches, and so it's a considerable achievement.
Bishop John Flack is the outgoing director of Rome's Anglican Centre. For the past 5 years, he's represented the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury here in the Vatican and worked to further the dialogue between the Catholic Church and the worldwide Anglican Communion.
Where I think we need to go on is not just to have ecumenism for 1 week of the year, but to make it part of every church's regular life.
Because it has become such a regular thing, it's perhaps difficult to find a new impetus, isn't it, to rediscover that courage that perhaps the people 100 years ago were looking at.
Yes, I think that's true. It is not easy to find a new focus. And I think it's even harder in a country like Italy, where 95% of people are Roman Catholics. So to find ecumenical partners is not as easy as it is in the multi-church situation in England or America.
Let's look a little bit about the kind of events that normally take place in England. Most churches up and down the country do mark this, don't they?
Yes, they do. And typically they will have united services, they will have exchange of pulpits so that an Anglican priest may preach in the Catholic Church and vice versa. They will certainly have public meetings in the evening where speakers will explore the whole ecumenical situation. And I've been doing a number of those meetings in England in previous years in this week.
This year, we're looking at the theme taken from St. Paul's writings to the Thessalonians, to pray unceasingly. That's the focus for all these activities this week. Paul, of course, was witnessing the divisions among the first Christian communities. How can we perhaps draw on the inspiration of his words for our situation of divided churches today?
Yes, well, the whole thing of preghiamo continuamente is very important, and the undergirding of our ecumenical discussions with prayer is vital. And in that context, I would, for instance, mention the Focolari movement, who have been wonderful in spending so much time praying for the unity of the church, which strengthens and upholds what we try to do in the week.
We think of ecumenism also in terms of collaboration on different projects, for example, social justice and so on. It's sometimes easy to lose sight of this prayer dimension, isn't it?
Yes, it's very easy to lose part of the prayer dimension. Again, we could mention the Comunità di Sant'Egidio, which meets daily for prayer, but also operates its works in a very ecumenical way.
The Week of Prayer for Christian Unity ends here in Rome with the great liturgy in the Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls. You've attended that liturgy, haven't you, each year during your time here. Tell us what it means to you very personally and the symbolism of this service.
Well, of course, it's the principal time in the year when I share the leadership of a liturgy with the Holy Father, and that's a very great privilege and honour and something I shall always remember. I think, too, it's the sight of St. Paul without the walls, full of thousands of people, and the realisation that many, many ordinary Catholics and Christians of other churches regard unity as still being an important goal, not something we should lose sight of despite the many obstacles. So it's a hopeful time in which I realise again that unity is still very much on the agenda.
Say the divisions within the Anglican world today and the difficulties that the worldwide community is facing makes it hard to look at this question of unity with other churches.
Yes.
The Anglican community is more seen as more focused on its own internal divisions.
Yes.
What's your reaction to that?
Yes, well, that's, I think, very much what the Archbishop of Canterbury is saying to us, that we must not be so concerned with our own problems as to miss what's happening out there in the world. And one of the things that I have always hoped is that the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Archbishop of York and other Anglican leaders will unite with the leadership of the Roman Catholic Church in speaking of the issues which very much are the concern of ordinary people: the future of the environment and the planet, the ending of poverty, the challenge to terrorism and violence in the world, and to religious fundamentalism. And to me, those things are of far more importance than the internal struggles of the churches. And I hope that one of the things that will draw us together is some concentration on those world issues.
The forthcoming Lambeth Conference in July and August is being seen as a defining moment for the Anglican Communion. What are your hopes as we look ahead to this important meeting?
The Lambeth Conference this year has the potential to be a very positive occasion, or a rather negative one. And the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, is marketing, if you like, the Lambeth Conference as a time when Anglican bishops come together to listen to one another in a secure atmosphere, to pray together, to learn from each other, and to seek the will of God on a range of issues. For the first time, this Lambeth Conference will not produce resolutions at the end of it. It is a time for bishops to reflect together, to get to know one another on a personal level, and to let the human spirit take over. And through that, I think the Archbishop and all of us are hoping and praying that there will be a better spirit of unity and a willingness to respect different views within the Anglican Communion. We can't all agree, but we do need to have an atmosphere of respect.
There may not be resolutions, but you will be looking at the future structure of the Communion, won't
you? Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. There will, I think, rather than resolutions, be some decisions made by the archbishops together as a result of what is said at Lambeth, and that will reflect on how the Anglican Communion can operate better as a communion through things like producing an Anglican covenant to which all provinces must sign up, having a common body of canon law, and the regular meetings of the primates, the archbishops, and in those ways to strengthen our unity and to help provinces to realise that they must consult with the rest of the communion before changing the way they operate.
There will, of course, be ecumenical observers at the Lambeth Conference, won't there? Because these issues are of enormous importance to the Catholic Church and other ecumenical partners.
Yes, there will indeed. And I'm delighted that my colleague in the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, Monsignor Don Bolan, is to be the leading Roman Catholic observer. And Monsignor Bolan is a person of experience who has ecumenism in his heart, and he will bring very important reflections from the Vatican with him to the Lambeth Conference.
These relations are built on trust and respect, and the friendship which has been established over 40 years of close relations, in which we have tried to address the doctrinal differences which separate us.
Monsignor Don Boland there, who is the official of the Vatican's Council for Christian Unity, responsible for relations with the Anglican world. He told us more about recent developments in the theological dialogue between Catholics and Anglicans.
Over the past year, the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, which is the means by which we address doctrinal issues, has not met. It completed a second phase of work with a publication in 2004 of a document on Mary, and a third phase has not yet been initiated. A second commission is the International Anglican Roman Catholic Commission for Unity and Mission, and that commission published a work during this past year entitled Growing Together in Unity and Mission. This text is an effort to synthesize what the Anglican Roman Catholic dialogue has achieved over the past 40 years. And it was published in the Catholic Church with a commentary by Bishop Bernard Longley, who is the auxiliary bishop of the Archdiocese of Westminster in England. Bishop Longley's commentary offers, from a Catholic perspective, an assessment of the strengths and weaknesses of this document, and it is now published for study within the Catholic Church and within the Anglican Communion. The most significant event coming up in 2008 is without doubt the Lambeth Conference, which brings together Anglican bishops from all over the world. In the past 3 or 4 years, there have been serious internal tensions within Anglicanism concerning human sexuality and concerning structures of authority with which to address those tensions. The Lambeth Conference hopes to address these issues by addressing two subjects. The ministry of bishops, one focus is to equip bishops for their ministry, and the second focus is Anglican identity. The Anglican bishops, under the leadership of the Archbishop of Canterbury, hope to work towards an Anglican covenant, which all Anglican provinces would sign on to. And if they're able to achieve this, this would seriously assist us ecumenically insofar as it would strengthen the internal coherence of the Anglican Communion. From a Catholic perspective, we are always saying that we need to know where our dialogue partner stands, and any strengthening of the internal bonds of within the Anglican Communion, which are also a strengthening of the apostolic faith, would certainly support our ecumenical relations.
My thanks there to Monsignor Don Bolan of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity and to Bishop John Flack, outgoing director of Rome's Anglican Centre. Rock star activist Bono and Nobel Peace Laureate Al Gore are among the celebrities joining politicians and business leaders in Davos this week for the annual World Economic Forum. The meeting, which opened on Wednesday, is examining some of the most pressing issues facing our planet, including climate change, poverty and inequality, declining natural resources, economic insecurity and terrorism. US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is among the political leaders joining key corporate decision makers for the 5-day gathering under the theme The Power of Collaborative Innovation.
I love the title of this World Economic Forum because I think it's the chance for us as Caritas, with people from all walks of the business life as well as the artistic world, to say you can be innovative too in addressing what are world issues of poverty and injustice.
The Catholic Church's Global Aid and Development Confederation, Caritas Internationalis, is also present at the Davos Forum for the very first time. Just before leaving for the Swiss resort, Secretary General Leslie Ann Knight told me she's taking a tough message to the world's financial leaders.
Inequality must be of concern to people in the business world as well as in civil society, those of us who work in international NGOs. And I think it's an opportunity for me, at least leading one of the biggest Catholic international NGOs, to say to world leaders, don't forget the poor, don't forget the injustices of our world. And most of them belong to member states of the United Nations and will be aware too of the anti-poverty targets which are embodied in the Millennium Development Goals. And I will be bringing that message to those leaders in Davos.
We are, of course, halfway through the target period for these Millennium Development Goals. There was such enthusiasm when they were set up just before the year 2000. It looks now that we're unlikely to achieve most of those ambitious goals. What are you going to say to these world leaders who basically have failed in what they promised to the poor?
That's the message I will be taking to them. We have failed to reach the targets at the halfway mark, and we also know that if we don't double efforts, we certainly will not meet them by 2015. And what I will be saying to them is, it's irresponsible of us, knowing that we can achieve those targets, not to make a concerted effort at the financial level to put our money where our mouths are and to commit the financial resources that the rich developed countries of the world most certainly can afford to meet those targets. When I think of the $3 trillion that are just spent on arms every year, a small percentage of that amount would meet the development, Millennium Development Target, say, for women in Africa. A very small percentage of that. It's a question of political will. And it's a question, too, of recognizing the consequences of not reaching those targets. The ongoing injustice, the ongoing desire of peoples to migrate. The root causes are going to continue to strike violence in countries and conflict in countries. We have the means to sort that out, and we don't. And I think the message I will be taking is to say, isn't it a crying shame in the 21st century that one woman in 16 in Africa dies in childbirth, whereas we in the developed world, our statistic on that is one in about 3,600. That is a crying shame, and we can do something about that.
We have heard these statistics before. The politicians, these business leaders, they hear these kind of statistics from the NGO world. What do you think perhaps can be done to try and energise, to try and find this political will to change the agenda as it has been? These meetings take place every year, the World Economic Forum. Many see them as a kind of talking shop. What is really needed to make a difference there, in your view?
I think the challenge is to the international NGOs themselves, whether we are now able to sit at the table at the World Economic Forum or at the World Social Forum to demonstrate how, when aid is well placed, when there is enough aid, and when it is put into programs where communities on the ground are protagonists of those programs, how it really works. If we were able to better demonstrate that, maybe those who have the power and the influence to determine the amount of aid would be better inclined to say, actually, yes, this really does work. So our challenge is to say, where you have put in aid in sufficient amounts into water, into women's health, into caring for children, into education, into constructing schools, look at the difference it makes to countries. The really good positive examples we have and the good practice. Let us, as the international non-governmental community, and those of us in Caritas, in Oxfam, in Christian Aid, in any of the big organisations, let's demonstrate that a bit better too.
You're putting your finger on perhaps what the faith-based groups really have to offer, and that is networks in the most isolated, the poorest parts of the world, where it's often difficult to see exactly what is going on from the perspective of a big UN organisation. How can you perhaps capitalise better on this real wealth that you have within the Caritas family?
I think it's raising awareness of world leaders at the UN itself and amongst business leaders that if they are serious about poverty eradication, then a network like Caritas, but most specifically the Catholic Church and faith organizations around the world, are critical to them achieving success in poverty alleviation. And why is that? I believe the UN itself, the UN nations and business people, would do well to recognise that in many countries in Africa, if not most countries in Africa, between 30 and 70% of health and education services are in the hands of the Catholic Church and other faith organisations. We are still responsible for a large, large percent of the care of the sick and the needy, the education of children. That is in our hands. It is our responsibility. Putting aid into that and development money into that, and I mean big time, not just small project level time, is going to help achieve the Millennium Development Goals. That is a clear message. And it would be irresponsible of the world community to ignore that potential that we have.
Are you talking in the terms of perhaps still being able to achieve some of these Millennium Development Goals at least?
I think just in health and education. Let me give you a very practical example. Across Africa now, faith organizations, and notably the Catholic Church, we are responsible for over 25% of all the care of HIV/AIDS patients, as well as the care of orphans from those who have died of HIV/AIDS. And yet the United Nations AIDS Fund provides us with under 3% of all the funding. If that could just increase to 25%, I am absolutely sure that we would far better reach the education and the health targets than if they don't recognise that.
You're looking at a number of issues around poverty and development. One of these on the agenda is also going to be the relatively new area of climate change and the effect, the devastating effect that this is having on your development work.
Yes, I think at the World Economic Forum we have Al Gore, who will be very, very keen to give us his message on that. From the Caritas perspective, and I think from many of the international NGOs, my view is that our strength and our comparative advantage is to be able to put on the table the evidence that we have from our poorest communities around the world of the direct impact on them of changing climate patterns. If you are a farmer in Chad, or Niger, or Ethiopia, or Zimbabwe, a fisherman in Sri Lanka or Bangladesh, if you are working on sugarcane plantations in Honduras or the Dominican Republic, you know in the day-to-day the impact on your life of flooding, of encroaching desert, of the sea levels rising. You know that on a day-to-day basis that your quality of life, your ability to sustain life, is reducing year by year. So taking that message through the lens of the poor, that is our duty and our responsibility to say climate change is real for the poor. This is what it feels like for them. What are you going to do about that in the developing rich world?
And my thanks there to Leslie Ann Knight, Secretary General of the Church's Global Aid and Development Confederation, Caritas Internationalis. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow or find us on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus. Mm-hmm.